that craggy moon face. They are just dreams, surely, and yet they seem real. As if the man is truly visiting Galley in some way during those meager hours he could carve out for sleep. He's met the man's droids, too. Some are cold protocol droids, others assassins, astromechs, and excavators who helped clear the ground at Jakku. And he's spoken time and again to an advisor, someone named Teshu. But Galley has only met the man himself once. And now, he's about to have his second meeting. He fears that death will be the result. He has been used for one purpose, and that purpose is now finished. The observatory is built. Galley did what he had to do to keep everyone away. None discovered it, and now it is buried beneath the sands near the plaintive hand. "My usefulness is over," he thinks. The man will kill him. Part of Galley finds strange comfort in that. Another part of him thinks, "No, I will kill the man first." Even though the man has magic. Real magic. And not the parlor tricks of the anchorites. The way he summoned sand to his hand like a flying serpent. Wait, he's here. Standing in the doorway. Hands clasped underneath the draping sleeves of his night-black robes. Only half of his face can be seen underneath the hood. In that glimpse, the boy can see the awfulness there, as if dark magic has distorted his visage. It is a good reminder that this man has true power, unlike anything Galley has ever seen. And with that, the boy quickly stifles any threat in his mind, lest the old sorcerer have the ability to pluck stray thoughts from inside his skull. Palpatine enters the room, and with a gentle swipe of his hand, a chair moves toward him. It eases and whirls, settling in front of Galley's own chair. The man sits, and his hand begins another gesture. The palm rises, as if asking a worshipper to get off his knees. Galley isn't sure if the gesture is meant for him, but he soon sees it isn't. Just as the chair moved, a table moves too, rising out of a telescoping portal in the floor. This table is like no table Galley knows. It is circular in shape, but with a square board carved into its top. That larger square is hand-etched with a field of smaller black and white squares, and in those squares are circles of opposite color. As the table rises, so too do pieces from within those circles. Each idol is a carving, crudely sculpted. They are symmetrical on each side of the board. Each side gets the same contingent of pieces. He sees pieces that look like beasts, like men with large hats, like warriors, like something that may in fact be a starship. He also sees pieces at the far end of each side that look not unlike Palpatine himself. Tall but bent and similarly robed. The one piece in front of Palpatine is in black robes with a white face. The piece in front of Galley is clad in white, with a dark countenance.
"Hello, Galley,"
Palpatine says.
"Hello."
"It has been some time."
He swallows a knot.
"Be strong. You are not some boy. You are almost a man now. You are Vorka, not Mouse. You have killed for him."
With that, he lifts his trembling chin to appear fearless and proud.
"It has."
"The artifacts are in place. The core has been drilled. The sentinels and my advisor Teshu report you have been very loyal to us indeed."
He draws a deep breath and shows his yellow teeth in a smile.
"The observatory is done. And so is your time on that wretched planet.
Yes.
Here it is, he thinks. His death awaits. The 10 years since he's seen this man were just a delay of the inevitable.
I don't want to die.
He says it not to plead, but just to say it. The man must know.
Of course you don't. You have a destiny. Those with destinies are bound to fight for life, because life and destiny are irrevocably intertwined.
And those without destinies?
The man waves his bone-white hand dismissively.
They do not know that they crave death, but they do.
Are you going to kill me?
It is not my intention.
Then why am I here?
As I say, your time on Jakku is over. You are done. You did as I asked, and so I am rewarding you with a new life away from that place.
His heart leaps.
Away from Jakku? Am I to go back there?
Not today. Perhaps one day.
I don't ever want to go back.
A slow smile spreads. The man's lips are empurpled, like a bruise sliced in half, so that a tongue and teeth may emerge through the slit.
And yet it may be your destiny. That part is unclear.
Palpatine leans forward, his pointed finger drawing invisible lines over the strange game board there.
Do you know this game, Galley?
I don't.
No, I suppose you wouldn't. It's a very old game. Chatez, in this iteration. Though over the eons I have seen it spawn many variants. Djarik, Mobius, Chess. In most of the iterations, the core mechanism remains.
Are we going to play?
We will. But first, I need you to understand not just how the pieces move, but why they move. Not just how to play, but why we play.
Palpatine smiles.
Listen closely.
And then Palpatine explains the game.
In the game of Chatez,
Palpatine tells the young man, Galley,
the board is called the Domain, and each piece upon the Domain has its own special role and its own special maneuvers. Each player is afforded one of each kind.
With an arthritic claw, the Emperor twists a piece that looks like a too thin man in a strange pillar-like hat.
The Vizier can only move along the diagonal, but has no limit to how far he may travel.
With the side of a yellowed nail, he taps another piece. A hulking hooded figure with something that might be a long rifle or a long blade. The abstraction of the carving makes it hard to tell. As the nail goes click, click, click against it, Palpatine says,
"This is the knight. He is versatile and can move 2 steps in any direction at all. Limited distance, but freedom of movement."
He goes on like that for a while, describing piece after piece. The outcast, the dowager, the disciple, the counselor, the beast, the craft. He describes how they move, what role they serve, even a little bit of the history. Later iterations of the game, he said, removed the outcast, for the outcast was too anarchic a piece, and the players sought a more stable game. Galley follows along, unsure of what he's supposed to be learning. But he pays great attention, never blinking, never turning his gaze away, lest it all disappear the moment he does.
Each piece exists in service to one other piece.
And here, the teacher grabs the final figure off the board. the robed piece that looks not unlike Palpatine himself.
The Imperator. All the pieces of the domain are here to protect the Imperator. If the Imperator falls, the game is over. That is true no matter how many pieces remain on the board. Do you see?
I see.
Tell me then what that means.
Galley swallows. He concentrates very hard to suss out the message, the lesson that the Emperor is trying to teach him. He clears his throat and says,
It means that without the Imperator, the domain cannot survive.
A smile creeps across the Emperor's face, like a centipede crawling on a cracked wall.
Good, good. That is true. That is insightful.
The smile suddenly falls away. The man's face twists up in a scowl of disappointment. With venom, the old man asserts,
But it is not quite right. It is not merely that the domain cannot survive. It is that those remaining behind do not deserve to survive.
His voice is laced with anger, the volume rising and the words coming faster as he continues.
They have one role. That role is to protect the Imperator. If an empire cannot protect its emperor, then the empire must be deemed a failure. It collapses not only because its central figure is gone, but because it must not be allowed to remain.
By the end of the old man's tirade, Galley tries to speak and cannot. He tries to breathe and cannot. He reaches for his neck and paws at his throat. A high-pitched keen, the only sound escaping his mouth. His face pulses and throbs. His vision begins to go dark. This is it. This is me dying. I have failed the lesson. Palpatine waves his hand, and the pressure closing Galley's throat is gone as fast as it came. The young man gasps and tries not to cry. Palpatine reaches out and takes Galley's hand with a grasp that is alarmingly gentle. The man's skin is papery and thin. It's almost sharp, too, as if running your hands along his flesh in the wrong direction will slice your own like a razor.
It angers me, Palpatine says sadly, to think of an empire that fails its emperor. But one must admit that it is possible. And in that possibility, it is wise to play the very long game. It is time I look to the unforgivable outcome and plan for that.
You are part of that plan.
How?
You, my son, are the contingency.
What is that?
There are unforeseen costs that must be paid. You may have to be the one who pays those costs, Galley. Which means it is time now to join the Empire. You will serve me in whatever way I require. And if all goes well, you will remain the contingency. If you fail me, then I will find another. For this role is one of great purpose and destiny. Will you be what I require?
I will.
That smile returns.
Most excellent.
But I do not know how.
That will come in time. For now, do you like opera?
Chapter 32. The red-headed boy sits on a ship without viewports, so he cannot see the endless dunes or the raging war going on above them. All he can see right now is the other children. 2 dozen of them, lining benches on each side of the transport ship. All of them in white. All of them staring at the young child as if he is a gobbet of meat, and they are a pack of slavering yenivores. They are hungry and feral, and he tries not to tremble. But the boy trembles harder instead. The door to the transport bay opens, and a man steps in. The boy knows this man, Counselor Rax. The man comes and stands before the boy, looking down.
Hello, Armitage.
Sir?
The red-headed boy says in a small voice.
Hello.
Has your father explained to you what's happening?
No, sir.
Brendel does not much like you, I suspect.
Tears line the boy's eyelids as he nods in agreement.
I suspect that is correct, sir.
Listen to you. The pinnacle of a private education. Such a crisp evocation of words for such a young lad. Even in fear, you speak clearly and plainly. Well done, Armitage.
The man sighs and kneels down.
I was not initially so fortunate as you. I was born here on Jakku. This horrible world. Those born here are already dead. Or so I once thought. But I was reborn. I was brought into the Empire by our late Emperor and made anew. I was turned from the little sand-scoured Jakku savage into something considerably more civilized. I was like you in one way, though. I, too, was scared.
I am scared, sir.
Yes, that is wise. Fear is useful when it guides us, but it becomes dangerous when it governs us. I'm here to tell you what is going to happen. We are going to take this ship to a location where a second ship waits. You and these other children will be taken far away. Your father will come, as will I. We will meet others at our destination. Together we will begin something new. We will leave all of this behind. Do you understand?
The boy does not, and he says as much.
No, sir. Not truly.
The man laughs softly.
That's fine, Armitage. It will all become clear one day. For now, I leave you with a gift.
What's that, sir?
These other children? They stare at you, don't they?
Yes, sir.
They want to kill you, I fear. They want to slash you with their fingernails. They want to bite you until you are just unrecognizable pieces. They would, if given half a chance, beat you with common rocks until all your limbs were broken sticks. Just as I once was a savage of Jakku, so too are these children savage in the same way. Your father's work has only heightened that impulse. He has sharpened them the way you do a knife.
The boy is truly afraid. The urge to go to the bathroom rises, and he is suddenly sure that he is going to wet himself. And he knows, too, that when he does, the other children will pounce on him at this man's command. They will smell his weakness, and they will slaughter him.
The gift. You want to know about the gift? Here it is, Armitage. You will lead these children. They will serve you. And one day, soon, your father will pass down his teachings to you. And you will learn to do what he did. It will be a life's work to take children like these savages and hammer their malleable minds into whatever shape you so require. They will be tools built for the work at hand. That is my gift to you, boy. One day your father will die. One day soon, I fear. And you will take his place.
He stands then and speaks to the other children.
Listen to me closely. This boy, Armitage Hux, commands you. You will do as he decides. You will give your lives for him if you must. Nod if you understand.
They all nod, in a simultaneity that both disturbs and thrills Armitage.
Thank you,
Armitage says to Councillor Rax.
It is my pleasure. The future of the Empire needs you.
Now sit tight. We're almost at the observatory. Our destiny isn't long now. With that, Rax turns on his heel and walks back through the rows of children and back out of the transport hold. The door seals shut behind him. The children all turn once more toward Armitage to stare. He fears that this has all been some trickster's ruse, some game played upon him. They won't listen to him. He doesn't command anything or anyone. They'll laugh at him, and, as the man said, they'll beat him, claw him, bite him. He draws in a quick intake of breath and points to one of the children with a wavering finger. The child is a boy like him, but with tar-dark hair and sun-marked skin.
You!
Armitage says to him. The boy says nothing.
Do you agree to do as I say?
Armitage asks. The dark-haired boy nods. Armitage balls his fingers into fists as he steadies himself.
I want you to hit the boy to the right of you. Hard!
The dark-haired boy turns to a sandy-haired, sallow-cheeked lad. Then he raises a fist and clubs that other boy in the side of the head. The boy cries out. A line of blood crawls from a small gash in the victim's cheek. Armitage feels a strange and sinister buzz of excitement. Chapter 33. Once again, the light of Jakku presses hard against Sloane's eyes as she and Brenton are ushered forth by Nora Wexley and that mad droid. When her eyes adjust anew, the first thing she sees in the sky is her ship, the Ravager. Sloane has a pang deep inside, like a string being plucked, the resultant vibration humming in her marrow. Regret courses through her like a poison. A choice presents itself now. She could run or overpower Nora in order to steal a ship. She could take that ship up to the Ravager. She could land and regain control. Not an easy task, no, but she is confident in her ability to get it done. Then she could take her ship and just go. It would not be an act of cowardice. It would be one of survival. The Ravager is a superstar destroyer, a dreadnought of mighty proportions. It is by itself a massive flying city. It has enough room to contain a powerful remnant of the Empire. It has the weapons to hold off a whole fleet, as it is doing right now by pushing back the New Republic Armada. She could take the Ravager. She could spare some portion of the Empire and flee into the stars with that massive vessel. With it, she could start over again. The Empire could start over again. But that would mean setting her vengeance aside. And that is something she just cannot do. The urge for revenge is like a hook in her cheek, and it's drawing her miserably toward it. Tug, tug, tug. Rax has ruined it all. He has touched the Empire with a filthy hand, and foul streaks of his treachery are everywhere, corroding all that she loves. The Empire to Sloane was an entity of order and discipline. It was about upholding stability in a chaotic galaxy. It was about vanquishing uncertainty and providing a way of things, a schematic, a backbone, a path for all to follow if they wanted to be safe. And now, it's this, a wild, brutal remnant, like a broken spear stuck in the sand. The troopers have turned to common thugs. The officers are haunted and overwhelmed. This is a primitive place, and it has made them primitive in return. The Empire that she loved is gone. That revelation reaches her again. And this time, for the last time. In her heart, she lets the Ravager go. Just as she let Adia Wright go. And just as she is letting all the hopes for the Empire's future go. Nora's blaster prods her in the back.
You want to keep moving? We don't have time for sightseeing, Admiral.
Just Sloan, she says. I'm an admiral no more. Just a rebel like you. She keeps moving toward the shuttle. And toward her vengeance. Akbar's chair swivels from station to station as he examines the battle map. His massive, gelatinous eyes flick their gaze among screens, assessing the situation. And the assessment is not ideal. This should have been easier. The New Republic fleet is larger. The Empire has been waning. On paper, it's an easy victory. And yet, so far, it has been anything but. They've already lost a contingent of corvettes. Two frigates are down. Countless starfighters have been lost to the swarm of TIEs that fill the void. Of course, Admiral Akbar is a student of history, and in many cases, smaller, lesser forces have outmatched and outfoxed their betters. The Ghostfinder fleet versus the Sith Armada, the Mandalorians versus the Grand Army of the Republic, and of course, the Rebel Alliance versus the Empire. History is rife with examples of weaker forces routing the stronger. And that may happen here, too, if they're not smart and cautious. The Empire has changed their tactics. They are fighting with a brutality and a chaos that has never been seen in their repertoire. One frigate broke in half when a single TIE bomber crashed head-on into the bridge connecting the two halves of the ship. They expend their weapons in every direction. Their attacks offer no rhyme or reason. The old Imperial maneuvers, always so neatly predictable and textbook, either are being willfully ignored or have simply been forgotten. That lends their defense a desperate, dangerous edge. It is quite honestly hard to combat. It's also, Akbar supposes, exactly what made his own fleet so difficult to fight his rebels. The other component is that damnable dreadnought. It has 10 times the weapons loadouts of a single Star Destroyer. Its shadow is deeper and wider than the dark of space beyond it. The other smaller destroyers circle it, parting long enough to allow torpedoes and turbolasers to lance out in the divide, injuring the New Republic fleet while protecting it. It's like a hive protecting its queen.
But if we kill the queen, the Hive will die.
Right now, 3 of the best and brightest ships in their fleet are surging against the Imperial fleet in order to take down that dreadnought. The Unity, the Amity, and the Concord. Those 3 Starhawks, with their blunt hatchet fronts, are meant to drive a wedge in the Empire's cordon of Star Destroyers. But they're simply not breaking through. They're tangling with the destroyers while taking fire from the Ravager. Taking all of the brunt while earning little of the advantage. He thinks to engage with Augate to discuss a new strategy, but that will have to wait, as the hologram of General Tyban appears. Tyban is a narrow-shouldered man. His head is square and bald as a cube of ice, and he's near as pale, too. His features are knotted with worry.
Status report?
Akbar asks.
Ground forces are finding some success, Admiral.
Tyban answers. The hologram flickers, not uncommon given the chaos of battle. So many frequencies and energy sources to interrupt the transmission.
We have pushed their line back, click by click. We may be advancing on their base by nightfall. That is, if we can stem our casualties. We're hemorrhaging lives. The Empire is fighting less like the Empire and more like an insurgent force, Admiral. They take risks. They sacrifice their soldiers. It's pandemonium. But they seem to be using it to their advantage and not their detriment.
We are experiencing similar up here,
Akbar growls.
But we are not so fortunate as you. We have gained little ground. Keep pushing forward. If you find success on the ground, it may earn us an edge here.
Tyban nods and hesitates before saying,
I should be there.
You are best on Chandrilla, kept at a distance.
And he is. Akbar told the Chancellor to keep one of their best military strategists in reserve, safe with her. He warned her to be wary that Jakku could be a ruse. The Empire tempts them to attack, thus leaving both Chandrilla and Nakadiya vulnerable to predation once more. That meant dividing their forces and keeping security high in the New Republic worlds. Still, that seems to have been a false concern. There's been no sign of any threat as yet.
You have your men on the ground, led by Lieutenant General Brockway.
But with me present...
We have no time for this, General Tyban. I thank you for your concern and your update.
Akbar ends the holographic transmission, then turns to open a channel to Augate. But his webbed hand pauses, held fixed over the console as he gazes out the viewport of the Home One Bridge. His blood goes cold as saline as he watches the tragedy unfold. One of the Star Destroyers, the Punishment, turns its nose drastically starboard. It turns right toward the Starhawk Amity. And the Amity has little room to maneuver, given its proximity both to Augate's Concord and to the battle raging all around it.
It's suicide,
Akbar thinks. He believes it must be an accident, but it seems to be deliberate. The Punishment's nose is like a sweeping blade, and it crashes into the blunt fore of the Amity, shearing through it. Fire blooms in space. Bodies drift. And the Punishment keeps going. Thrusters burn at the back, and repulsors fire along the side. The Destroyer becomes a weapon as it cuts the Starhawk in half, debris from both ships cascading outward as lightning coruscates between the two obliterated vessels. Augate's own ship is right in the middle of it all. He hurriedly opens the channel. Everything focuses to a sharp point. Augate hears Akbar in her ear, is faintly aware of his presence cast in holographic blue to her right. He's warning her about the debris field coming her way, but he doesn't need to tell her about it. She sees it on her screens. 100 red motes blink like furious eyes winking in the dark. Each is a piece of debris, and each piece rockets toward her like a weapon. The wreckage of not one ship, but two. That wave of destruction will be here in less than 3 minutes. She yells for Spawn to strengthen the port side shields, but she knows they'll only hold up so long. That many fragments? It's too much.
Abandon ship, Commodore!
Akbar roars.
That is an order!
Yes, sir, she says, her voice sounding 1,000 light years away. This is what it's come down to, she thinks. Her return to war is over as quickly as it began. Their brute force strategy to break the blockade of Star Destroyers has ended. The Amity is down. The Concord won't last. She barks for the communications officer to warn the Unity they have room to maneuver, to get out of range. Not only will the Concord create its own debris field, but with that Star Destroyer gone and the two Starhawks vacating the field, that will leave the Unity vulnerable to attacks from that massive dreadnought waiting in the center of it all. Abandon ship. She makes the call. It's the right thing to do, and they're going to have to move fast. Worst thing is, they can only use the pods on the starboard side. Otherwise, they'd launch right into the wave of wreckage. Red lights pulse. Klaxons blare. A flurry of activity rises around her as the people of the bridge do as they have been trained to do, streaming efficiently and effectively toward the exits. The Capital Command crew have escape pods all their own and within spitting distance of the bridge. Her artificial eye focuses on the screens. She sweeps her finger ahead, fast-forwarding the expected consequences of what's coming. The computer is predictive and models the likeliest outcome.
The debris will damage but not destroy the Concord. It will, however, leave them open to attack from the Dreadnought. And they're close enough to the top of Jakku's atmosphere that the ship will likely drop toward the surface, crashing into sand and stone. They will lose the Concord one way or another. Spawn grabs her elbow.
Commodore, it's time.
I'm coming, she says. I'll be right there. But it's a lie.
Commodore?
I said go. I'll be along. Akbar starts to ask her what she's doing. She ends communication with him. I'm sorry, Admiral. But she realizes something. If the destruction of the Punishment and the Amity open up her ship to attack by the Dreadnought, then it also opens up the Dreadnought to attack by the Concord. She has her chance. It's one she likely cannot survive. But the costs of war are heavy, even in victory. That has been one of her guiding, governing principles. It is a grudging reality that informs all that she does in battle. Her hand is no longer trembling. It has been stayed, perhaps by the first moment of certainty she's felt in a very long time. How about that? She uses her newly steady hand to urge forward the Concord's throttle so that it seizes the gap in the Star Destroyer barricade, thrusting hard toward the Dreadnought. Above her head, lights flick from red to green, pod bays launching one after the other as her people abandon ship. Good. Go. Get safe. She takes a moment to look around her. She's alone, like a little island in the center of a calm, quiet lake. Her screens light up. As expected, the Dreadnought is unleashing hell. Right as debris from the two eradicated ships begins slamming into the Concord. Lights go dark, then bright, then dark again. The ship shakes and bangs, as if it's a toy held in the hand of a careless child. From Algate's bridge console, she flicks over to the weapons consoles. She prepares everything they have, every bit of ordnance this ship has to bear.
Bring hell to my door? I'll bring it to yours.
She fires everything. Banks of turbo lasers, ion torpedoes, concussion missiles. Bright lines of death streaking through the black. Lines of the same fire, castigation, heat, launching from the Ravager toward her. Like threads of light seeking each other. But they will pass each other instead, each heading onward to an act of destruction, not creation. The Concord roars toward it, even as its deflector shields begin to fail on the side. The ship tilts starboard. Debris punches through the hull. The engines gutter. She wills the ship to keep going. Hope is a fire fast extinguished inside her. She sees the fury unleashed from the Dreadnought. Predictive analysis shows the Concord losing this fight. Her volley cannot match that from the Ravager. The Ravager is a beast and will not be sated. She will damage it, to what extent she cannot say. But if she opens it up to attack, even still, her mind attempts the calculations. If she opens up a hole in the side of that thing, it's something, but it's still not enough. And if the other Star Destroyers close the gap and protect the injury made against the Ravager, then what? Out there, through the cathedral-like arches of glass, she sees the weapon streaming toward her.
This is it.
But then, Algate has a new idea. War brings with it moments of inevitability. A sinking ship, an onrushing horde, a mortal wound. The worst kind, Akbar thinks, are the moments when you watch friends die. Especially those times when it happens slowly. Too slowly. As if all the moments leading up to it are drawn out and given time like images flash-pulsed into your mind's eye. This is one of those times. Algate cuts communication with him, and he sees the Concord burn hard and move toward the Dreadnought as both it and the monstrous Ravager launch everything at each other. problem is, the Ravager's weapons are far greater than those of a single Starhawk. The Starhawk's weapons are prodigious and better than even he has on the Home One. It is the uttermost of their tech, bleeding-edge armament. But by itself, it can only hope to wound the Dreadnought. And it will die in service of that act. Augate is still on board. He knows this. She is going down with her ship. A dramatic gesture that he hopes has purpose behind it. He suspects she feels that she must command every moment between now and her end. That it should be her hand directing the ship and its fusillade of fire. But the Starhawk makes an unexpected turn. The Concord banks sharply to the starboard, maneuvering quickly to turn that side of itself toward the incoming attack. The port is already damaged by the debris field. The starboard side taking the hit, with the shields already gone, Akbar sees, may not destroy the Starhawk outright, but it'll sink it. Already its engines are damaged on the far side. Atmosphere will grab that vessel like mud sucking on a soldier's boot. A hologram flashes over his console. It's Augate.
Augate, get off that ship!
Admiral, listen. Get everyone you can to hit that dreadnought from aft. Take out its engines. Send every starfighter, every CR-90, anyone.
Commodore, I command you to abandon that vessel!
Admiral, it literally pains me to deny your order. But please, trust me. Listen to me. The engines!
Out the viewport and on his screen, he watches the fusillade from the Ravager close in on the Concorde.
What are you doing? Hitting those engines? The Ravager is not moving. The engines aren't where we need to be concentrating our fire.
Just trust me.
Commodore.
Thank you, Admiral. It has been the highest honor.
Kirsta!
And then she's gone again. Just trust me. War brings with it moments of inevitability, yes. But it also carries with it the opposite. Moments of grave uncertainty, bridged only by acts of blind faith. When they say to one another, "May the Force be with you," it is precisely this that they mean. It is a wish that when the time comes to leap into the void and to make a decision based on instinct and trust, you are rewarded for that act and not punished. The hope is that if you meet the galaxy halfway, it meets you in the middle and carries you the rest of the distance. Akbar decides to trust and to leap and to pray that the Force is with them all. The exchange of destruction is a mighty one. The Concorde's barrage slams into the Ravager, ripping a hole in the side of the gargantuan ship with the ferocity of a biting, rending rancor. The injury is black and deep, but not fatal. And the Dreadnought's own weapons strike the Concorde, slipping past what little is left of the deflector shields and punching clean through it. Oxygen whistles out into the void. Fire plumes as chemicals off-gas into space. The ship groans. Somewhere in the belly of the ship, explosions start going off. Fuel cells and magna batteries chain reacting. Boom, boom, boom! It won't detonate the whole ship, but it has gutted it. The ship is dead in the water. And without the repulsors from underneath keeping it aloft, the atmosphere of Jakku is like a reaching, claiming hand. She feels the ship drift downward, drifting as it goes. But the Starhawks were designed with one thing in mind: upgrade. So long did the Rebels endure an aging piecemeal fleet that when the time came to finally design something new to serve the nascent Republic, they went all in. Every internal system, every external design feature, every weapon, all of it was upgraded beyond the watermark set by the Mon Cala ships prior, and beyond the known capabilities of the Empire's extant ships. One of the features that saw the largest boost in ability? The tractor beam. The role of the tractor beam is simple: to grab an object in space usually a spacecraft, in order to usher it safely into a docking bay, or to seize the vessel and pull it closer. The tractor beams on a Star Destroyer were notoriously vicious, with the strength to draw a Corellian corvette into its bay, or to stop a Nebulon frigate from making the escape to lightspeed. The tractor beam on the Starhawk is 10 times that. Magnite crystals amplify both the range and the strength of the beam. A Starhawk could capture and move a ship many times its own size. Augate dials up the tractor beam, points it at the Ravager. She fires.
If I'm going down to the ground, she thinks, you're coming with me.
Grand Moff Rand sits in a chair on the bridge of the Ravager. Up until now, he has felt supremely in control of this battle. The Ravager is a vessel whose might is presently unparalleled in the Imperial fleet, and to have been given command of it by Rax himself is an honor he will not squander. His forces have stopped the rebel-born false Republic fleet at every turn. Though he is no true tactician, he has many great minds working for him, and their plan of forming a perimeter of vessels around the Dreadnought was a sound one. Until now. The three ships pressing at the barrier, Starhawks, he believes they are called, manufactured for the false Republic, were held fast at the margins, even though the Star Destroyers were taking heavy fire as a result. And then something happened with the punishment. The officer in charge of that ship, Captain Groff, appeared in a panic. He said that the destroyer was suffering a coolant leak from the shield generators that was cascading through the upper levels. Some areas were experiencing fires. He seemed positively deranged. That was a factor Rand had long been worried about. Coming to this desolate world, this far-flung system, brought with it the chance to wear on a man's soul. It could erode a weaker mind. When he explained that fear to Counselor Rax, the man said,
"Do not worry about that. The Imperials that have come to Jakku are the greatest of our kind. We will not break. The unkindness of this world will only bolster us. We will harden like calluses, Rand."
And that was the end of that. In Rax, they trusted. Rand still trusts him. They have survived this long, and there's no doubt that Rax is admirable, capable, a true hero of the Empire. Rand is a fan of belt-tightening, and using Jakku to harden their hearts against the fight to come was, to his mind, genius. But now, what he feared most has come true. Groff lost it. He said that he would not abandon his ship. The New Republic would torture him and execute him. His own people would turn on him. He was frothing with distemper, screaming suddenly about how the New Republic were traitors, and they all deserved death like dogs, and how they must give no quarter, no quarter at all. The last thing he said was,
"I must be a stronger blade! A blade with which to slit the throats of the traitors that crawl on their bellies toward our door!"
Rand recognized it as a line from Counselor Rax's speech. Groff's comms went dark after that, and then he crashed the punishment into the nearest Starhawk. That led to a chain of events even now Rand does not completely understand. Debris from the two ships hit a second Starhawk, and that one he felt sure would be out of the picture. But no. That ship accelerated in the gap right toward the Ravager, firing all its weapons. And so Rand demanded they return fire all the way, reserving every weapon system they had, launching ordnance in the direction of the onrushing Starhawk, a ship that now identifies itself as the Concorde. The Concorde turned broadside and took the hits just as the Ravager took its own. That ship was scuttled. He did not need his systems to confirm it. His eyes told him all he needed to know. Meanwhile, the Ravager was fine. Damaged, yes, and now more vulnerable. But he rerouted power to the deflectors to magnify protection over that chasm, and then, the strangest thing. The Concorde snared the Dreadnought with a tractor beam. Rand is not a man given to humor.
His wife, Danasik, says that she believes he laughs once, perhaps twice a year. But here, he almost laughed. Why in all of space and time would the captain of that Starhawk see fit to lash him with a paltry tractor beam? Perhaps to save herself the fall into atmosphere? The Ravager serving as an anchor? He hates to tell her, but gravity is a cruel mistress. It takes what it wants and will not be denied. The Ravager moves suddenly. It moves, but he does not command it to move.
Status report!
He barks, his calm voice suffering a sudden break to it, like that of a boy just getting hair on his chest.
Status report!
Nearby, Vice Admiral Pearson appears, sweat beating on his brow.
The Starhawk has affixed us with its tractor beam.
Yes, I know that. How are we...
The ship drifts again.
How is it moving us?
I have no idea. It must be powerful.
Strengthen our engines. Reverse course. Fire repulsors.
Alarms go off. The ship shakes again. This time the sensation is different. Like something is hitting it. Pearson's eyes go wide.
They're concentrating fire on our aft.
The screens show a sudden flurry of starfighters. Every variety brought to bear against their engines. If they lose those...
Engine 5 just went dark!
An ensign yells.
Now sub-engines 3 through 6!
An engineering officer cries.
The Concorde is trying to track us down to Jakku.
The nerve.
Fire all weapons at that Starhawk!
Sir,
Pearson responds.
The weapon systems will cycle in 2 minutes. We already hit them with everything we had. On your orders.
Then send TIEs after it!
But they are protecting our flank! The engines!
Again, the ship shakes. Worse this time. And when it does, it's like trying to move something heavy and failing until it suddenly gives way. The Ravager slides and dips downward so hard, Rand's jaw snaps tight, teeth closing hard on his tongue. He tastes blood and curses.
The atmosphere,
Pearson says.
We're entering Atmo, sir.
Bolster the engines! Bolster the repulsors! Bolster everything!
But in his head, Rand knows the score. It is too late. The Ravager is done for. He has squandered his chance, and now hope is lost. The greatest weapon in the Empire's arsenal is lost because of him. A flagging fear nags him.
It should be Ray Sloan in this chair, not me.
The one thing about Rand is that he is not a sycophant. He is no zealot. He admires Rax. He trusted him. But he will not be crucified for this. In the chaos of the moment, the flickering lights, the shaking ship, the flurry of movement going on across the bridge, Rand sneaks quietly away, boards an escape pod, and jettisons himself into space. The Concorde has leashed the larger ship with its powerful tractor beam, and it draws it down toward atmosphere. New Republic starfighters hit the engines of the Ravager, one after the other, again and again. A returning loop of fire, while a pair of CR-90s keep the TIEs off their backs. The Unity, the last remaining Starhawk, has pulled back to a safe distance and is using its considerable weapons load to provide the Concorde with cover, peppering the nearby Star Destroyers with as much fire as it can muster. And then the Starhawk dips considerably as the atmosphere kisses it, the underside of the ship glowing with the sudden heat of re-entry. Blade Squadron reports that the last of the Ravager's main engines are out. Only the sub-engines remain, and they won't save it. The Dreadnought's front end is the first to follow the Starhawk, carving a line across the top of the sky where the black goes to blue, like a fading bruise. An aura of fire begins to glow around the Ravager's fore. Akbar watches the two Titans fall. The Concorde goes first. Augate likely remains on board. She won't answer his comms, but a scan of the Starhawk shows that not a single pod remains undamaged, and the fighter bays are empty or destroyed. She has no way off that ship, and it is too late and too risky for a rescue. As the Starhawk drops, it drags the Ravager with it, like a rider pulling its beast mount toward the edge of a waterfall. Closer, closer, until both plunge through space and into sky. Until the gravity throttles each and draws them ineluctably downward. Akbar grabs the comm and warns those below.
Soldiers and pilots of the New Republic, the Dreadnought Ravager is down. It falls to Jakku. Beware debris and take cover!
All around him are the cheers of those on the bridge of the Home One, as they watch the titanic vessel go faster and faster toward Jakku. But Akbar does not cheer. He nods quietly and mutters a small entreaty to the Force, asking it to protect those down below, underneath these falling giants, and further, to accept Kirsta Agate as one of its own.
I'm really getting the hang of this.
On Akiva, they have these bugs that fly over still water. Polywings, they're called. And they flit over the surface, changing course like the snap of one's fingers. They move this way and that, snagging smaller flies out of the air and eating them on the go. Chomp. Temin wants to be like those polywings. That's how he sees his X-Wing. He pivots the starfighter fast as lightning, moving erratically so that the TIEs don't see him coming. His heart is going so fast in his chest, he fears it's going to punch its way out. His blood roars like a river in his ears. An effervescent thrill elevates him to almost giddy heights. He's buoyed, too, by knowing that his mother is still alive, and that Bones is protecting her.
This is a good day, he thinks. The New Republic is going to win this war. My mother is alive. My best friend is here. And I'm in an X-Wing. And I'm not dead.
He cackles like Coco with his radio mic on. Coco cackles right back as the two of them cross in front of the other, slaloming around each other, spitting lasers at escaping TIEs. One forms up on Wedge's tail, and Temin bites his lip to repress the grin that threatens to split his old face.
Phantom Leader, you've got a bug on your back. Let me swat him for you.
Wedge brings the X-Wing low over a dry red ravine, past a squadron of New Republic soldiers taking cover there in the shadows afforded by the gully. The TIE whips through the space behind Phantom Leader's X-Wing, and Temin thinks to come in at an odd angle. Otherwise, he risks accidentally hitting Wedge with laser fire. He swoops left, then turns the nose of his ship right again. The TIE lines up in his sights. But Temin doesn't need screens. He fires, and the four cannons on his open foil wings throw spears of plasma. But they never find their target. Temin cries out as a piece of black metal crashes down right in front of him, separating him from his oblique pursuit of the TIE. It crashes into the ground, sending up a cloud of red dust. Temin peels the ship away from its destined course, turning the X-Wing sharply to avoid other debris.
Blast it! That looked like a piece from a starship.
A turbine, by the look of it. His comms growl with Admiral Akbar's voice.
Soldiers and pilots of the New Republic, the Dreadnought Ravager is down. It falls to Jakku. Beware debris and take cover!
The Ravager? It's down? He whoops as his giddy feeling surges higher. With the Ravager gone, that'll open up a huge hole in the Imperial fleet. That big monster was everything the Empire had. If it's gone, that means the New Republic just won this battle. And maybe the whole war.
Now it's all just cleanup.
Wedge still has that bug on him, so Temin flicks the X-Wing back to the right again, looking for Phantom Leader in his scopes. Ah, there he is, dead ahead, zipping over a flat plain where the sand looks like waves frozen in space and time. He spies Yara coming in from the other side, and he thinks,